from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Michael Krasny. Is finding a romantic partner tops on your list for 2020? Most likely you're on an app, because increasingly it's the most likely way to meet somebody new. But if you've used the apps, you know it's a mixed bag of beans, starting with a compulsive but not necessarily goal-oriented design of the software and moving on to the way people behave in this brave new world of stranger dating. Badly, much of the time. This hour, we want to hear your stories, even if you found somebody delightful on your first date. Also, we have experts on hand to talk about the state of dating, mating, and relating to one another in the age of swiping right. That's coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. Did you know dating apps originated in the gay community? Grindr and Scruff, launched in 2009 and 2010, respectively. Then in 2012 came Tinder, which shot to the top, becoming the most popular dating app on the market. Without a doubt, apps have expanded our pool of potential partners beyond friends of friends. And let's face it, these are dangerous times to be looking for love in the workplace. But can we talk? Apps have their downsides, too. We want to hear your stories this hour, the good, the bad, and the funny. And we've got some great folks to talk with us about this subject. Ashley Fetters, staff writer with The Atlantic and author of The Atlantic article, The 5 Years That Changed Dating. Reuben J. Thomas, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of New Mexico, also co-author of the 2019 study, Disintermediating Your Friends, How Online Dating is in the United States Displaces Other Ways of Meeting, and Jesus G. Smith, assistant professor of ethnic studies at Lawrence University. Reuben, why don't we start with you? Is it fair to say meeting a significant other online has essentially replaced meeting through friends?
Yeah, I'd say so. And not just meeting through friends, but just about every other way of finding a partner has been decreasing over the past 10 or so years, while meeting online is the only way that is increasing. And now it's the most common way that people meet.
So that doesn't seem to be the same as saying that people trust the technology more, maybe just that they don't feel they really have any other options.
It's true that as the norm shifts, it becomes something that people may feel like they have to do because everybody else is doing it, because that's where the marketplace is.
Ashley Fetters, can you talk about the fact that you know, when you have people meeting over the internet, essentially what you have is stranger dating, and that kind of means that there are no repercussions for people being rude or creepy.
Certainly, yeah. Tinder's point, obviously, is, you know, to make it easier for people to find each other to have, you know, romantic or sexual interactions with. But obviously what happens when you have this sort of context vacuum that results from pairing people off just based on geographical proximity, you end up with people on dates with folks that they have really no background info on. Obviously, in the old model of dating, dates were set up because there was chemistry or because there was interest there. Now it's like there's much less stopping people who really should not be on a date with each other from being on a date with each other. So when I have talked to couples therapists, for instance, I talked to one in New York who has, you know, said he talks to a lot of people who come in kind of feeling dejected because people are much ruder on dates than they used to be. He said he talks to a lot of people who show up for dates only to have their date say, "Oh, I don't, you don't look like I thought you would," and they leave the date. You know, obviously here what we're talking about is every date is a blind date. There's no real context behind it. It's kind of a context vacuum, like I said. And you know, I think also in the older model of dating, it was like you would be set up through friends. And so there was like one friend who was going to hear about it.
Exactly. Right.
One friend was a jerk to your other friend. I think that has disappeared in a sense.
Jesus, any thoughts along those lines?
Yeah, it's super interesting to hear this because, you know, for us gay men who've been dating in this way, it's kind of always had that level of, you know, anonymity and kind of not really knowing people because, you know, we oftentimes were in spaces where we weren't close to other gay men. So we had to use these sorts of resources to figure out who, you know, wasn't out but was open to meeting people and just different things like that. So it's kind of always been the sort of risk that a lot of gay men take and meeting each other. But I agree with everyone. It's, you know, the shift and the kind of risks that are there are really prominent and really interesting.
Risk mitigation, a phrase I didn't think I would be using talking about dating. You know, here's a question, and any one of you can jump in on this one. How are older women, black women, Asian men supposed to get past people's prejudices online? We have the data now to see that when people have the opportunity to screen that way, they do.
I'll go ahead. You know, that's a really good point, and that's something that I actually explore a lot in my research is kind of how people utilize this technology, and it's kind of like a McDonald's. You know, they have it their way, and they try to craft specifically what they want on their app. So they'll say sometimes up front, you know, I'm not interested in black women, I'm not interested in, or a very popular moniker in the gay community is no fats, no femmes, no blacks or Asians. So you'll see people kind of being very upfront with the sort of things that they don't want. And the idea from the people that I've interviewed is that, you know, it's helpful for everyone is how some people would say. They'll say, hey, you don't want to date someone who has these ideas and you don't want to find out later. And others, you know, feel like, OK, yeah, I see this profile. That's not someone I want to deal with. But at the same time, it's super interesting if you think about, you know, I think in the past, you kind of took that risk of dating someone, going on a blind date and trying to figure out, hey, if something's going to connect. But in this way, you really cut off that opportunity and you just go directly to almost this fantasy of what people want versus the reality of how diverse people are.
There's a good point. There's something about the app experience where you do sort of feel like, yeah, you could just pick this tomato out of the bin at the supermarket, as opposed to thinking of humans as being special and different and, you know, worth finding out who they are beyond that initial photo. Ashley Fetters, do we see a similar or different dynamics at play when you're talking about straight people?
Yeah, I think you do. You know, there's a very popular theory that that dating apps have made it harder to settle on someone. You end up with this sort of endless
swipe
buffet of options. Yes, yeah. Exactly. It makes it harder to pick one. I think this is a really popular theory that Aziz Ansari has really highlighted in a lot of his work. You know, obviously he's someone who talks about dating a lot, and this is a big thesis of his. I know there are some critics of that, though. You know, there is the other theory that I think carries a lot of weight here. This is something that Eli Finkel, the sociologist, likes to say in his work, is that, you know, maybe the grass is greener elsewhere, but happy farmers don't notice. Like, you find something that you like and you stick with it. People have always had the same amount of options. Now it's maybe easier to find them, but people who have something they like stick with it.
What about the idea that heterosexual men and heterosexual women play the app differently? Like, for instance, you have guys who swipe on every woman and then women who swipe on, I don't know, 1 in 75.
You know, I don't I haven't really, I'll say this honestly, I haven't really come across a whole lot of differences in how men and women use the app in my work. Lots of people, regardless of gender, regardless of orientation, have ended up just, you know, people know what they want. They either are there to swipe forever, they're there to look for, you know, a commitment or transactional sex or, you know, something casual. People know what they want when they start swiping.
Is what Ashley's describing accurate in your view, Ruben?
I'd say that, as far as the endless options, I had a student actually pursuing this research, and I've decided that I don't think it's actually true. I mean, I think it's definitely true for maybe some subpopulation. But overall, couples who meet online are just as stable as those who meet offline. So, and there's not really been an effect of the internet on making worse stability in the relationship rate. The rate of people who are in long-term relationships is very stable going back to the 1980s. So any idea that the internet is changing that in a good or a bad way, the evidence just isn't there for it. But what I think it does change a lot is the kind of effort and what people do to get into that relationship. So this swiping right on tons of people or the amount of work and effort that people have to put in individually has probably changed a lot from, say, the 1980s.
Interesting. So what would be an example of that?
Well, in like the 1980s, you were single and you just weren't meeting any potential partners through your everyday life, through the kind of voluntary organizations or soccer team or your workplace or your friends or family. And to make the effort to find a date meant either bugging your friends or family to set you up with somebody or putting yourself into situations where you might expand your horizons and meet people at, say, a bar or a club, or suddenly volunteering in this new organization that might have a lot of single people, where it's a day you go online and you search through tons of different advertisements that people have, and you go on a lot of dates with people maybe you shouldn't be going on dates with who are complete strangers. But that vastly expands your option for finding others without having to go through these other organizations or these other kinds of steps. It kind of cuts to the chase between the searcher and the person they might want to date, but it puts a lot more work in the hands of the individual to, you know, look through those ads and set up all these dates and maybe meet a lot of people who aren't right.
Well, when you say meet a lot of people who aren't right, I think we should talk about that, because there are a lot of people who experience, you could call it app fatigue, but what it is the fatigue of going on date after date after date with people who are not so interesting, who are not as interesting anyway as Netflix and a bowl of popcorn at home.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to hear what Jesus and Ashley say, though.
Jesus, you want to jump in here?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
I find that super interesting. I think it's just to go back a little bit, I think it's really fascinating because, yeah, I do think that's true, that you find stability in both arenas, of course. And I think what people might speak to as some of the issues that they might experience online are really just amplified issues that you might find offline in the dating arena. So oftentimes, for instance, many, if let's say there's a hierarchy of desire online and there's all sorts of factors that kind of go into, you know, the profiles that are being hit up more often than others, the people who get to go on dates more often than others, and kind of get that what we're talking about, that bored experience versus others who do hit up, who do try to speak to or reach out to individuals and oftentimes get rejected or don't get heard from. And that, attributes like race or body type and height and age, all those sorts of different factors play into, I think, the way that people, are able to date and how often they are able to go on dates and possibly even the sort of dates they can go on. And I don't know if that's, and actually I would say that's probably not because the online realm is more egregious than the offline world, but it could be that a lot of this stuff just gets amplified and a lot of this stuff just gets, it happens quicker. So if I go online, I might see a lot more profiles that are saying no blacks or a lot more black women who are being rejected or black men or Asian men, for instance, based on racial stereotypes and things like that. And I think that stuff happens offline as well. And so maybe because of the way the online world kind of works, where you don't have to engage with people, you hear a lot of people talk about that a little more often. And so maybe the people who get to go on dates kind of sit in this space, or especially go on lots of dates where they get exhausted of dating, sit in this space where, they happen to be younger or more fit and more attractive, what society might say is more attractive. And so you get a lot more people hitting you up for dates, for instance, and you get a lot more opportunity for that. Maybe that's the case.
The same thing happened at, high school dances or in the bar. It's just happening online.
Right.
Have we been at this, Ashley, long enough for there to have been trends? Like, if Tinder started getting big in 2013, can we say that some things are out of fashion or in fashion at this point?
Absolutely. I was just about to bring up, I mean, my colleague Julie Beck at The Atlantic has written about the rise of, you know, this thing called dating app fatigue, like you mentioned. And I wanted to point out, she wrote a story about dating app fatigue in 2014. So we've been fatigued for a while. I think some of us are very, very fatigued. You know, obviously, it's this feeling of just being so tired of swiping on the apps and a real longing to meet someone in real life, which that opens up a whole other conversation, I think you could say. Obviously, the problem that dating apps were aiming to solve with their invention was that meeting someone in real life is, in fact, really hard, as we have established a few minutes ago. But regardless, I do think that there in the coming years will be a renewed interest and a renewed appetite for, you know, sort of these more incidental, spontaneous meetings, the kind that do, in fact, require chatting with strangers. That's the biggest trend that I've seen within, you know, obviously, dating apps themselves are probably one of the bigger and more influential things to happen to dating as we've known it ever. But within, you know, the world as we know it now that we have dating apps, that is one of the bigger trends I've seen.
That makes me think of a question. But before I ask it, I'm going to ask our listeners, what's your experience with dating and building relationships in the era of online dating? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, because you know you have a good story to tell or a complaint. We're willing to hear it. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. We have a Facebook page. You can email your questions to forum at kqed.org. And now that question that I wanted to ask, I guess, Ruben, maybe you can kick us off here. The industry has already consolidated, mostly under Match, right?
Not entirely. Match is definitely one of the more popular ones, but I don't think they control the industry in any way, such as like Facebook controls the social network market or Amazon controls the online buying market. I don't think it's really that consolidated. And we see that in our data when people say what websites they met on. Match and eHarmony are very common, but so are a lot of other of the smaller sites like Plenty of Fish or it's not just Tinder for the apps. There's also Bumble. I think it's still very much an open marketplace.
An open marketplace. Maybe that offers some hope that somebody's going to build a better mousetrap than the one we have now. Kelly writes, I tried Match.com and it was utterly disastrous. No more dating for me ever again. Oh no, Kelly, get back out there somehow. Jessica writes, online dating is fun if you don't take it too seriously. It's not for finding a lifelong partner because the pretense is there already. My best relationships were with men I was friends with first because it felt like we got to know each other without needing to put on a show. And I felt like they valued me as a person first. That seems like really good advice. Ashley, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, I think that really speaks to the fact that, you know, there's no chemistry quite like the chemistry that you know is already there, like the organic, you know we already get along. We know we're a good pair already. But I think what Tinder and dating apps have done is they've leveled the playing field for people who don't experience that in their lives very often, who don't experience like, oh, I've got all these friends who I think I could maybe turn into dating partners. What it does is it introduces, you know, people to new people when they don't have those existing, sources of real chemistry or romantic spark.
Some people do say it's just a numbers game. You got to get out there if you want, to get any hits. A volume operation. I love all these phrases, organic dating, volume operation, hierarchy of desire. Let's go to the phones and talk to Bryce in Napa. Hi, Bryce.
Hello there.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Doing all right. You know, I'm a 20-year-old man. I'm a college student, straight. And so I feel that a lot of times it can be uncomfortable in this time of, you know, Me Too. And I don't want to make a woman feel uncomfortable, you know, with some sort of advance and something like that, where it's difficult to know it's going to be reciprocated. So the online scene, it gives you the opportunity, I feel like, to, it's like the green light. It's like, you know, what people are going to be out there looking for. And for someone who's young and can't go to bars, maybe it's a similar experience, but it definitely gives the sort of avenue, I feel like, that can feel like a lot of people need to struggle to find for. So I don't know. It's an interesting perspective.
Hey, Susan, any thoughts on that? It does seem like when you're on an app, at least, you both know you're both looking for somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really good point. You know, a lot of women have gone to specific apps, and this is where I think a lot of creators do an interesting job of creating apps that speak to the sort of need at the time. So men who might have sent unsolicited penis pics, right, to women who then flee certain apps to go to other apps in which they have a lot more autonomy and a lot more control on who they can speak to and engage with. And I think that actually is something that helps a lot of the time because it allows, as was mentioned before, kind of a level playing field. It allows certain people more control who might have in the past had less of that and a lot more opportunity for engagement. So then when we do go to particular apps, it becomes a little more clear, okay, well, in this app, you can't have any, you know, you can't have your shirt off in your profile pic, and you have to talk about your background or something like that. And that sends a particular message, I think, to users versus some other apps where it might be, okay, you can show your abs or, you know, take your shirt off or, you know, and it sends a different sort of message. So you're right, like certain apps you can get on and everybody can kind of have that idea in that space. Oh, we are here and we all know what we're kind of looking for in some way. So I think as the caller brought up, I think it's really true. It's like, yeah, this creates an interesting opportunity for people who can't go to bars where lots of people meet. This is a different time, too. Lots of people meet at work or at church. And so now things are kind of shifting, I think, in many positive ways where people can meet online and have different sorts of experiences that are not tied to work, where it can be very complicated, or not tied to social spaces with people we don't particularly want in our business, like our parents or our friends. Right. And so I think it does present this unique opportunity, which is why I think a lot of people are invested in the apps in this way. And I think that as we move forward, we might see a lot more of this, especially as more and more apps are catering to different groups like Farmers Only or Black People Meet and stuff like that. So I think you start to get this more unique space where people get to meet, and it's safer in some ways, and people can feel like, okay, we're here for the same thing.
If I could piggyback on what Jesus
sure.
said real quick. First, real quick, just never overestimate the extent to which there's a green light. There's still a lot of ambiguity when people go on dates, but the caller's absolutely right that the ambiguity is lessened and there is a bit of a fast-tracking that kind of happens in relationships when they start online because of this disconnect, as Jesus was talking about, from the other parts of people's lives. So the couples who meet online, their half-life to getting married is about 3 to 4 years. Whereas for the couples who meet offline, it's like 10 years.
Wow.
It's a much faster pathway into marriage. And there's not actually any difference in the breakup rate. And there may even be slightly higher satisfaction for the couples who meet online than offline.
Wow. Well, that's interesting data that I had no idea about. Listeners, stay in the conversation. You're on the fast track with us to the air when you give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We are talking about online dating with Ashley Fetters, staff writer for The Atlantic, Reuben J. Thomas, associate professor at the Department of Sociology at the University of New Mexico, and Jesus G. Smith, assistant professor of Ethnic Studies at Lawrence University. Let us know what your questions, concerns, and comments are. If I can't think of any subject more important to talk about just ahead of a brand new year. You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, and we're talking about dating in 2019, 2020, dating apps. What does the future of dating look like with these apps? Is there a better mousetrap out there or in the wings? How would you construct it? What are your questions, concerns, complaints that you want to direct to our guests? Ashley Fetters, staff writer of The Atlantic, Reuben J. Thomas, associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of New Mexico, and Jesus G. Smith, assistant professor of Ethnic Studies at Lawrence University. Well, let's get right to it and the phones, because they are lighting up. We're talking to Christian in Daly City.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good this morning.
So what's your story?
Well, I met my wife about 5 years ago on OkCupid, and I have no complaints.
No complaints. Now, who spotted whose profile first? How did you initially contact each other?
We just started talking at first, kind of more pen pals, and then we moved forward on a common thing. She needed something. She came to see me, and I took her out to dinner, and it's been kind of, that's kind of the story.
Wow, mazel tov. Ashley Fetters, you know, Christian brings up a point I guess we seem to be making repeatedly during this hour, which is that good behavior, good dating behavior online looks a lot like good dating behavior offline. You have, you know, civil conversations. Perhaps you attempt to flirt with each other, charm each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my central thesis on Tinder, and I think Jesus has touched on this already a little bit, is that Tinder is only ever as moral or immoral, or, you know, dating apps is, generally are only as, like I said, moral or immoral or smart, stupid, shallow as the people who are using them. All they do really is show people other people in their area or within whatever age range, gender, et cetera, that they've selected. And then from there, it's just up to users, like when or whether they talk to each other, what they do from that point forward. So, you know, if people are behaving well and treating each other nicely and flirting in ways that are attractive to each other, things are going to move forward in the same way that they always have. You know, obviously, if there's hatefulness or abuse or harassment or people just being shallow, I tend to think, well, that falls on the human who chose to be hateful or abusive or harassing or shallow more than it falls on the dating app or the online dating system itself. Obviously, like, what's so important to remember about systems like these is they are human on one end and human on the other.
At the end of the day, and I suppose at the beginning. Thank you so much for that, Christian. Let's go now to Sarah in Hayward.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I have a question, a complaint and a question. My experience as a 58-year-old female on online dating apps is that the vast majority of the men who write to me are would-be scammers. They start off by telling me I have the most beautiful smile, I'm an angel from heaven, and I haven't even uploaded a picture yet. And I was strung along a few years ago by a guy for several weeks, and then he had an emergency, and he wanted me to send him $45,000. And when I saw the word wire, I snapped back to reality and realized it was a scam. But that's my complaint. My question is, where can I go for online dating where I don't have to wade through the 95% of people who are not real people and want my money to get to the real ones that actually can meet because they're local?
Ruben, is that something you can talk about? What do the numbers tell us about how many scammers are out there?
I don't really know the numbers about that, but I think a good general rule is that the internet is filled with scammers. If you get emails from people you don't know, it's probably a scam. And that's going to be true, I think, on most dating sites, unless there's some that are just really well cultivated. But I think, as was said before, it's a numbers game, and wherever the caller is going, whichever site they go to, they're probably going to have to wade through a lot of bad and not real kinds of messages and potential dates. But I will say that for people who are in a thin part of the dating market, which includes women at middle age and past middle age, online dating represents both this wonderful opportunity and a curse where it will greatly improve the odds of finding a partner. But it also involves, as you said earlier, facing a lot of upfront discrimination and having to wade through a lot of bogus stuff.
And also sexual predators. We've seen headlines recently where, you know, companies are being called out for not screening people who are reported by people who've gone out with those predators and had a bad time.
There was once a movement to require all online dating websites to background check everyone on the website. And there was an attempt to get legislation passed in many states. And it was all being done by this one company that wanted to corner the market because they were already doing that. And that failed. And I don't think that kind of thing is going to succeed for a variety of reasons. I think, you know, as Ashley said earlier, it's just a way of connecting people. And so you could... It's stranger dating, so you could literally meet anybody online. That is both the horrible thing about it and the beautiful, magical thing about it. any two people can meet each other online. And so that greatly improves the dating odds for just about everyone who goes online compared to their everyday life. It also greatly improves the rate of or increases the rate of interracial, interreligious and couples from different social classes. But it also involves, you know, stranger dating can be dangerous. It can be a scam as well.
Ron writes, I joined Yahoo Personals in the late 1990s when it was only highly educated men and women with a computer who were online. Doctors, lawyers, engineers, etc. Now any moron with a phone can get online. I don't know about that. A listener asks, funny that your conversation seems to be about superficialities and demographics. Do the profile's content not matter at all? We women spend so much time trying to get our profiles just right. Ashley, any thoughts?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think, humans are more shallow than we like to admit. I think, you know, you'd have some of the same problems on Tinder that you have in a bar or at a singles meetup. You know, the most attractive people are going to get the most attention. And I think that's, you know, to pretend it's otherwise in real life than it is online is maybe to give ourselves a little too much credit for depth in our dating preferences.
I guess, Jesus, you've talked before in this hour about the people who get to go on dates. So what does somebody who is nowhere near a 10, so to speak, do to win in this environment?
I mean, that's it's wise to talk about how we do use our profiles oftentimes to communicate to others. And we do and many people can read those profiles and engage, and they can say so much. And I do think that works to a certain extent, of course, with people seeing certain interests on their on other people's profiles and making those sorts of connections. But I also think, like, the reality is we are individuals who are part of a society that has all these different issues in its society, and that gets reflected in these creators of these apps. And so that's going to impact people as well. So, for instance, in some of my research, people would go specifically online, and, you know, we could spend hours decorating our profiles, putting up our best pictures and stuff like that. But they would technically use the apps because it had this searchability built in, where you could search age ranges, or you could search for body types, or you could search for race. And so you could literally cut out a lot of the variables that you weren't interested in just to focus on others, those that you are interested in. And so, you know, like many people have been saying, that's helpful in some ways, sure, and harmful in others, because I think that so many people look to these apps and look to internet dating kind of as this idea that it was going to be different from society. And maybe there are differences that we're seeing, but I also think we're a reflection of kind of that space. So I going back to your original question, I do think that people do read people's apps, and they do, you know, I do think it's a good idea to put your pictures up if you want, and some apps allow you to block those so you can show if you want. I do think the more that you put up and the more that you share in your apps, the higher your chances of being hit up. That's kind of the reality, because people know much more of what's there and what they can engage with.
Aaron asks, I met my wife on Craigslist. Oh, so go ahead, Ashley, sorry about that.
I just wanted to jump in and say, I mean, there are plenty of people who, you know, log onto dating apps hoping to read an engaging or funny or amusing profile. And, you know, there's a critical mass of people there who, like, if you are someone who works on your profile, the best case scenario is one of those people will find you. And then, of course, the people who are not out there reading profiles and just swiping on pictures, you won't swipe on each other. And that's also the best case scenario.
Right. That's a good point. Let's go to the phones now. And Aaron in San Francisco.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So as a gay man in San Francisco, there are multiple apps. It's really interesting with a marriage equality. Conversationally, you hear a lot more, I want, you know, a traditional relationship. Now that marriage is an option, I think folks are considering, you know, longer term monogamy. Then you get on the apps and it's a whole different ball game, so to speak. And the other thing, I'm just curious if that's a general dating app phenomena or just to the gay population. And the other thing is that the apps are really, you know, it's really hard to figure out what the transaction is. It could be anything from a, you know, innocent date to something, you know, much different. And it's kind of scary seeing how much code there is around drug use and prostitution, especially on Grindr and on Scruff. And I'm just wondering also, what is the responsibility of these companies from keeping that from happening?
Jesus, do you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, I mean, so I would start with the last part, the responsibilities of these companies. It's very interesting because there have been movements from different groups in response to kind of their experiences on these apps. And they've been happening for so long. So I think of when it comes to racial discrimination or the different types of discrimination that people might see online, for instance, certain apps were even created in response. So Scruff is kind of the response, you know, to, you know, Grindr was the big space for a long time where younger people were on, thinner people, obviously, and then they wanted something different. So there's, you know, apps that get created in response to kind of the negativity you might see in these spaces. But also, Grindr just recently changed its policies around the kind of negative stuff that people can post on their profiles. So they have the Kinder Grindr after people complaining for so long about some of the abuses they would experience online. So in terms of, you know, some of the things that we've been talking about, you know, sexual risks that you might see online, drug use, things like that. The fact of the matter is dating and sex, period, these things are risky. And that's, again, something that's offline, something that's online. These things are going to have lots of risk involved. And I do think that in some ways they might be amplified online in a different way. And I think that's what we all kind of speak to. I think it's so interesting, the idea, you know, marriage equality did pass. Were we going to see differences in dating habits? And I think it's interesting because if I talk to some of my gay friends, they'll say, well, you know, Tinder, which is like the straight version of Grindr for us, it's like a lot more of the gay men on Tinder are looking for dates versus a lot more of the gay men on Grindr are kind of just looking for, you know, more casual sex or friendships or something like that. And so I do think, again, speaking to some of the things we brought up, some of these apps definitely get understood as the space in which this is where you go to date and this is where you go to hook up. Heterosexuals might say plenty of fish might be a little more about, you know, or more open to hookups or friendships and things like that versus some other spaces like eHarmony, where it seems to be more about dating. I will say, though, I have met my partner that I've been with since 2015 on Grindr. So it's very possible, if you, depending on what you want, to find that partner and that person who also shares your needs, as many as basically everyone's kind of brought up.
Wonderful answer there, Jesus. Let's go to Stephanie in Santa Rosa.
So I'm 19 years old, and I've used a couple of different dating apps. And the one thing that I've realized is, especially a lot of people my age, they never actually want to meet up. I get a lot of people who either try to get very hot and heavy very quickly, which isn't my speed, and or people that will flirt for an extended period of time, but then never end up actually wanting to go any further than that. Kind of wondering how you guys think I can, or anybody can, kind of get around that.
Ruben, I sort of wonder about that as well. Sometimes it seems like the apps are designed to maximize your time on the app, or maybe it's just people who are messed up.
There's definitely screening that one should do when using these kinds of, whether it's an app or a dating site. If the goal is to have an offline relationship, don't drag it out online. Set up a face-to-face meeting in a public place that has a very short time commitment, like coffee or lunch, as soon as you actually realize you want to meet this person, because you don't know what the chemistry is going to be like face-to-face, and you don't want to have months and months of time invested in someone who just isn't really there.
Sorry, I take it you're stopping there.
Yeah, sorry.
Ashley, anything you wanted to add there?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think one thing that's really been interesting to me that's come up in my reporting is I have found that even when people are setting people up as matchmakers, like I know this person and I know this other person, I think they'd be great together, let's set up a date. The hardest part is setting up a date like via a text message. There's just very little momentum and like, you know, one person can like text the other and the other person's busy. And then, you know, you like lose some momentum when the person responds 4 hours later and they're like, oh, sorry, I can't do Thursday. And then they don't suggest something else. Right. So you just lose a lot of this, you know, spark that might have been there and you lose some of the sense that the other person is excited about it. And so there are certain ways to get around this, I think. One strategy I've heard is people you know, just like to call the person on the phone if they get their phone number, or like, you know, message them right away and say, hey, how about this day at 7:15 at this bar? And then they can either say like, no, that doesn't work for me, or like, yes, see you there. You know, that's like you get right into it and just kind of start off with logistics, right? Because I think the logistics and the talking about it is what really sucks some of the fun out of it in a lot of ways. And then I have heard of a couple people doing this, which I love. You know, you ask for the person's phone number, and if they, you know, trust you enough to to give you their phone number via the app, you call them at some point and just kind of have a chat. And then at the end of the call, say like, okay, what do you think? Should we go on a date based on like, you know, just having this conversation? Do we like each other enough? Do we think this is, you know, something we would actually spend time and money and energy on getting to a date, buying a drink, buying dinner, whatever, to invest? Like, do we feel that there's enough here to go forward?
So
another thing I'd like to say, what works for people in their 30s may not work for people in their teenager years and vice versa.
Oh, true.
Those are very different markets.
Yeah.
And in fact, the people who use online dating the most in Pew studies are the really young, but the couples who meet online who are long-term are disproportionately people in their 30s and 40s.
That makes sense. I mean, you think you kind of want to play around when you're younger and you want to settle down when you're older.
Mm-hmm.
Also, people who are younger have a lot of opportunities to find partners in their offline life, like in college or school or through their networks of friends. But people in their 30s and 40s disproportionately have friends who are already partnered up. They disproportionately have workplaces filled with coupled up people. So their everyday lives aren't very rich in possible romances.
I want to get to a few comments. Jane writes, for the 58-year-old lady looking for non-scam dating, try a meetup. There's one in San Francisco called Young at Heart for people 55 and up. Aaron asks, I met my wife on Craigslist in 2004 and we wrote each other for weeks before going on a date. Does it matter that we have moved to text-based interactions for dating? I feel, Ashley, like you kind of addressed that to some extent. Vicky writes, since I'm older, divorced, and not looking for a husband and kids, I just enjoy meeting interesting men who may or may not become romantic partners. That said, if I were younger and looking for a more traditional romantic relationship, I think I would feel frustrated. It can be exhausting. I think I'll just let that stand. Let's go now to Suzanne in San Jose.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I was calling because I am one of those older women who was divorced at 47. It took me 12 years to find the love of my life, and we finally married when we were 60. I'm now 65. So I guess what I'd like to say is that, especially if you're an older person dating, it really is the only way that I can think of to meet people. None of my friends ever made a referral. None. They all thought, oh, I don't know any people that would be good for you. Well, how do they know what would be good for me? I know what's good for me. So I think when you're dating in older life, you have some huge advantages that you don't have when you're younger. First of all, you know how your kids turned out. They tell you about their health problems. You know whether or not how they treat their parents, or if their parents are no longer in the picture. You know, these are all clues. And I think that if you have a good sense of yourself and you set your own standards and you know what you're looking for, it's actually not that hard. It takes time. I didn't love the fact that it took 12 years, but I sure am glad with the results.
Well, congratulations, Suzanne. I mean, you know, it does kind of seem, and this is a question for anybody, that a lot of this just has to do with resilience, the willingness to get out there often, and have a sense of humor about the time it takes and the lemons you meet.
That's one of the things I would say has not changed at all about dating. You know what I mean? Like, dating apps changed so many things about the expectations that we have about where we will meet our partners, like how long we will talk to them before we go on a date with them, rather than, you know, the kind of the old way of doing things. But one of the eternal truths of dating is that it takes a long time to find someone you like and want to spend time with and want to bond with and want to spend all this quality time and invest all this energy in. That's one of the things that I don't see ever changing.
Let's go to another call now. Tom in Oakland. Hi, Tom.
Hey there. Should I just start?
Just start.
I started a year where I had gotten out of a long-term relationship, and I decided, since I jumped into that one immediately after a previous long-term relationship, that I would spend a year dating. So, of course, online, you have plenty of options. And I actually took notes on all my dates, and I just one or two sentence notes, because I went on so many dates that it would be confusing otherwise. I went on 45 first dates.
Wow.
In 1 year, 25 second dates and 16 third dates even. And it was, I just learned so much about so many people, and it was just a fantastic experience. I did end up, you know, with someone that I consider to be a permanent someone now, but that first year was just amazing. And my rule was that everyone got a second date, because people on first dates, you don't really, everyone's on first date behavior, so you don't really get anything out of that. So I just had a fantastic experience online, even though I have to say I was also very selective on who I would even go out with on a first date.
So you had a sense of adventure, clearly, but not too big a sense of adventure.
Oh, no, yeah, and I was truthfully disappointed in myself in the limitations that I just found myself, exceeding to. I couldn't venture out too far from my comfort zone, but there's just so many people online, even at my age, which was 50 at the time. It's an amazing experience, and now I have no interest in going back online, but for that year, it was a fantastic thing.
Well, thank you, Tom, for sharing that inspirational story. Hopefully some folks out there will move past their fears and doubts and get off the couch. I think we've got time for at least one more question. Let's talk to Daniel in San Jose.
Hi, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, wow. I've been listening to the program, and I met my girlfriend over Tinder, and things are going really well. I originally grew up in New York City, and a lot of my friends that lived and stayed in New York all kind of ended up with people that we grew up with. And I'm just wondering, the kind of relationships that people have with people you grew up with, they know you better than anybody and in ways that people that you meet online can't know you. And I just want to know what this means for, like, the future of relationships. And if meeting people online, is that better than people who know each other their whole lives?
Ruben, you've commented on this. Any additional thoughts?
I think it's better from the point of view of breaking down group boundaries, because the people who people grow up with tend to be very similar to themselves and from the same kinds of families. And yeah, there is that lifetime kind of experience together, but it also makes for much more, in general, much more homogenous relationships. And so if as a society we can get more people to go on more dates with strangers and form relationships across racial, ethnic, religious, social class, and geographic boundaries, then it's an integrating force in society.
Any thoughts along those lines, Jesus?
Yeah, I want to say, echo that. Yeah, I think I mentioned earlier how dating is a risk, and there's so much reward that can come from it if we are open to it too. And so I think, yeah, it can work out for a lot of us if we're very selective, but I want to encourage a lot of people to do this. Number one, it can be a very rewarding experience, but also keep your heart open, because oftentimes what we think it's going to be everything we want, what's the fantasy of what we want, is not necessarily what we need. And so oftentimes it could be surprising how someone that we were closed off to can be really enriching to our experience.
Michael writes, I met my girlfriend through our running club in San Francisco, but never knew whether she was available or interested. And I didn't want to make the club an uncomfortable space by asking her out until we matched on an app, and that gave me the green light to go for it. Another listener writes, it seems to me that dating apps have a fundamental conflict of interest. The quicker they help me find a long-term relationship, the sooner they stop making money from me. Any thoughts on that, Ashley?
I mean, it's a very good point. It's a very, very good point. I mean, I do know that it took a long time to figure out how to monetize Tinder anyway. So, you know, I think that's probably a new thing that they're probably going to end up, figuring out more ways to have people spend more time on the app. Obviously, you've seen sort of the expansion of dating apps into business connections and friend connections. And I think these are some of the ways, too, that dating apps have recognized that problem of like, well, our most successful users are going to stop using the app. And so they've kind of expanded out into connections that you will want to make more than one of and have more time to develop.
So fairly quickly, Ashley, what are your thoughts for the next decade? Where are we headed with all of this?
I think it goes back to something I had said a little bit earlier, but I do think we'll kind of see a return or a renewed appetite for meeting in person. You know, one of the more fascinating things that came across my desk this year was this book called The Offline Dating Method. The author is named Camille Virginia, and it just was so interesting to me because it really was just a book offering tips on how to talk to strangers and how to flirt in a way that might produce a real date. It was how to talk to someone in a park, how to approach someone in a bar, how to talk to someone, you know, like in your running club, like that caller said. And, you know, obviously it felt very old school to me and just, you know, a book about how to flirt. But the fact that it came out in 2019 makes it a really fascinating artifact. And I think a harbinger of things to come. Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Well, what a pleasure talking with you guys. Ashley Fetter, staff writer for The Atlantic, Reuben J. Thomas with the Department of Sociology at the University of New Mexico, and Jesus G. Smith at Lawrence University. We've been talking about dating apps, and boy, is there more to say. But we've come to the end of the hour. So I will say good luck out there, guys. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.